I'd like to thank the Realistic Theories program here at ITP for inviting me to discuss some various points having to do with atomic scale electronic phenomena in recuperates. And today I'm going to talk about the vortex core structure. I'm pretty sure I'll get to the end of the discussion of recuperates. It's not clear whether I'll be able to get onto the ruthenates, so you guys should put a stop to me when the time comes. Okay. So let's say recuperate work, Jenny Hoffman, who's not here, and Kyle McElroy, who's right here, are the people working on this problem, and a former member of my group, Eric Hudson, who's now in MIT, also made key contributions. And ruthenate vortices, student in my group, Sudeep Dutta, and then postdoc, Christian Lupien, and a former postdoc, Barry Barker, worked on that problem. And these studies, the BISCO studies, were carried out with materials from Isaki and Uchida. So first I'll very quickly tell you how one images vortices. Scanning tunneling microscopy involves parking an atomically sharp tip above a clean, flat conducting surface. One can bias the surface with a battery, and the tip is at virtual ground, so if tunneling can occur, electron current bridges this gap and is detected in this current amplifier. So let's imagine that this is the density of electronic states, this black line of the sample, and this is the density of states in the tip. It's a good metal, usually a piece of tungsten or platinum, iridium, or gold, sometimes niobium. If it's a normal metal, this is a flat density of states, and all the states are filled up to the Fermi level of the tip. This bias shifts the level of the tip relative to the level of the sample, and thus it reveals these empty states. This blue region are the states unoccupied states into which these electrons can tunnel. So the tunneling current is, in this simple model, proportional to the integral of the density of states in the sample up to the energy, which is given by the voltage of the battery. Now, of more interest for us is the local density of electronic states at a given energy. And one can measure that by changing the tip bias by a small amount. That will change the current by a small amount. And this sliver of current here is the delta V multiplied by the density of states at that voltage, at that energy. So DI is the local density of states in the sample times DV. This is a theoretical statement. Based upon this theory, one can measure DI DV as a function of V. And that is a function which is, in theory, proportional to the local density of states as a function of E at that exact location. And then with enough technology, one can do this throughout the sample as a function of magnetic field, as a function of temperature, as a function of doping in BISCO. So this is the primary observable, the IDV as a function of V and location and whatever other parameters are available. So here's a conventional, possibly not conventional, but until recently it's been referred to as a conventional superconductor. It's certainly an S-wave low-temperature superconductor. Sorry. Here's a picture of the surface with atomic resolution. You see the charge density wave with period 3 very clearly, high, low, low, high, high, low, low. So this is a topographic image where you already see the redistribution of charge due to the nesting effects. At low temperatures, one can park the tip at some location, take a spectrum. It looks like this. This is data taken at 250 millikelvin in one of our instruments. And this spectrum is completely independent of location when the magnetic field is off. Please stop me and ask questions.
So it doesn't matter where you put your tip, whether it's the dark region or the light region, you still get the same spectrum?
So we haven't gone back to do something like Fourier transform spectroscopic mapping of niobium diselenide, which I think could be a very revealing tool, but we just haven't had the opportunity to do it yet.
So what is dark and what is light?
So, okay. So the topographic image is the location of the tip, which is required to keep the tunnel current constant at a fixed bias.
I see.
So it purports to be the integral of the density of states in an energy range which is controlled by the bias voltage. So here it's the integral from the Fermi level to minus 100 millivolts.
Right.
Keep that constant, since the tunneling matrix element would vary as a function of location due to the crystalline structure of the material,
right.
Then the feedback system gives you an image
right.
which purports to be the location of the atom.
On the right instead, does not depend on the position?
Does not.
Also the intensity, the form not, also the intensity.
The intensity depends exponentially. Yeah.
So white means you have to pull back.
White means you have to pull back.
So the point is that I can think of this as a map of the matrix element. And the point is that the matrix element is varying strongly with position, but the spectral function is not.
This is something which is not, it's like a Dirichlet function, let's say. The structural factor,
yeah.
which is just a constant energy, or we depend on position.
The truth is that the precise meaning of the so-called topographic image in STM has not been that well defined in theory. Okay, I mean, Fermi-Golden rule, tunneling descriptions of the situation tell you that the tip has to back up because the density of states appears to be higher at some location. But a true microscopic calculation, even for a material like this, at least to my knowledge, has not been worked out of the tunneling problem in STM. But this is what is conventionally referred to the topographic image. We think of it as the trajectory of the tip to maintain a constant integrated density of states. So here's the Karoly-Degen matricon result. If you have a vortex core in a type 2 superconductor in the presence of a field, there can be bound states inside whose energy levels depend on delta, the superconducting energy gap squared over the Fermi level. And here's the famous work of Harald Hess, now from quite a long time ago, in which he measured the tunneling spectrum as a function of location near a vortex core in niobium diselenide. And there's a very big contrast. Empirically, there's a very big contrast, because when you're away from the core, the density of states at the Fermi level is very low. It's a S-wave superconductor. So you have low signal here when you're away from the core. And then when you approach and go into the core, you get this so-called zero bias conductance peak, which is thought of as a sum of a large number of unresolved Karoly-like states. Now, you can use that fact to image the cores. Here's some images that we took at Berkeley. You map the IDV at fixed tunnel junction resistance. So the trajectory is still keeping the integrated density of states constant. And now you map this DIDV near the Fermi level. And you can see it's a beautiful Abrakosov vortex lattice. And also you can see that the quasiparticle physics changes. This energy is exactly at the Fermi level, and this is 240 microvolts away. The picture is quite different because there's various interferences between the quasiparticles in this environment. And this is a very big field of view. A whole experiment on, the vortex core in a cuprate is going to be 10 angstroms, which is, 200 times smaller than this whole field of view. So this is a very big structure.
What's the Milton spacing inside the core?
Well, in theory, you can look it up. It's never been resolved in an experiment.
What material was the tip?
Pardon me?
What was the tip material?
I don't remember, but it was very likely to be tungsten. So for the D-wave BCS case, so here I mean you have a D-wave gap. Usually in these theories, people took a cylindrical Fermi surface, and then they took the superconducting energy gap to have D-wave structure to do these calculations. So of course, one would expect the spectrum at one point to look like this. But at the core of a vortex, quite a number of workers in the early and mid-90s solving the D-wave BCS problem in different approximations came to the conclusion that there should be a big peak at zero bias in the core of the D-wave vortex. Now, this is not the same Karoly-Degen state bound in the core of an S-wave vortex. This is an extended state which decays as a power law and reaches out into the regions far from the core. It should have been fourfold symmetric, it should have been oriented with the nodes, and it has this power law decay. So this was searched for many years and is still being searched for. But the STM experiments really reveal a very different situation. So here's work from Oyston Fisher's group in 95 on YBCO, where here's the spectrum far away from the core. Here's the spectrum inside the core. So what you see is there's no zero bias conductance peak. And there are core states in here. The energy is around 5 millivolts for YBCO. And the coherence peaks are destroyed at the symmetry point of the vortex core. And here is work, again, from Geneva on 2212. Again, there's no zero bias conductance peak in the core of these vortices. In this experiment, they were not able to resolve the core states. That's the next thing I want to discuss. On 2212, when we cryocleave the crystal, we reveal the bismuth oxide surface. The copper oxygen plane is here, so there's two layers between the tip and the CO2 plane. That surface looks like this. It's pretty complicated. You have the supermodulation, which is a 26 angstrom periodic modulation, which is three-dimensional. It's in the copper oxygen plane as well as being in all the other planes of the material, but it's weaker in the copper oxygen plane. Then there's a further reconstruction that I'll show you on the line of maximum stress. And then also there's this electronic heterogeneity that I will discuss a little bit tomorrow. So you can zoom in a little bit. Each light dot here now is at the location of a bismuth atom. And now you see this strange additional reconstruction along the line of maximum stress. So now you can see each bismuth atom very clearly. This is the realistic theorist's x-axis, and this is a realistic theorist's y-axis, or vice versa. It's a very complicated environment.
What do you mean? Is X along the copper oxygen bond, or is it 45 degrees?
Yeah, so the bismuth oxide in this crystal, the copper oxygen bond and the bismuth, the copper atoms are underneath the bismuth atoms. So X is along the copper oxygen bond. So to be specific, underneath each bismuth atom is the copper atom, 4.7 angstroms down. And here is the size and orientation of the bismuth oxide, BiO plaquette, and also the CuO2 plaquette, about 5 angstroms underneath. By the way, I won't have time to discuss it today, but this amount of precision is, I mean, it looks nice, but it's also of great utility in giving a precise ruler for high precision measurements in Fourier space. So it's actually a necessity to have resolution like this to get both precision and accuracy in more detailed experiments. So here's a typical spectrum on the bismuth oxide plane. Today I really don't want to address the issue of how it could be possible for the spectrum to be so good at that plane, but it is, and at that plane we get access to basically all the canonical phenomena of a superconductor. So it remains to be determined how the matrix elements are worked out, but empirically we get access to a great deal of information. Okay, so here's how we do an experiment. Here's a topographic image of a particular surface of 2212. So we can stop the tip at each location. Let's say we stop there, and then we measure the whole spectrum. And then we move to the next location a few angstroms away and measure another spectrum and so on. So in a 128 pixel array, that's about 1.6 million measurements. And we basically mapping the spectroscopic structure of this field of view. The acquisition time for an experiment like that is several days, during which we remain registered to the atoms in that field of view. So to show you the data, I use this color scale. At a given location, so here's an image of the local density of states at this energy. So at a given location, if you see this green image, it means the density of states is here near the normal density of states. If it turns yellow and red, you're at a region where there's a high peak in the density of states. If it turns blue, you're down deep inside the gap, and black is at the Fermi level. So now I'll run a movie where this variable is the quasiparticle energy, and this is a color image of the quasiparticle density of states. So at high energies, everything is relatively homogeneous. It starts to come down here. So when we reach a point here near 60, 70 millivolts, it becomes heterogeneous. We see rapid variations as a function of location. Very intense variations. Go over the coherence peaks, drop down here inside the gap. The IDV now has only very weak variations as a function of location. And at the Fermi level, we see the unitary scatterers. And then when we exit on the other side, this is the empty states. We see the weak modulations, then the very strong heterogeneous coherence peak signal. And then when we exit on the other side again, it becomes relatively homogeneous. There has always been some skepticism about these results. All I can say is that in at least 5 years of studies of many tens, maybe even hundreds of samples, we always observe this when we do this experiment. Now, it varies as a function of doping, field, and all the canonical variables, but this is what we see. So let's talk about searching for vortex cores. So in this field of view, this is a relatively...
Back to the previous picture. What is the energy in which there is more disomogeneity? What is the energy which you can think there is more disomogeneity?
Well, it's a function of doping, but let's say near optimal doping, it's around 40 millielectron volts. As you go down in doping, it goes up in energy. As you go up in doping, it goes down in energy. I'll make a few comments about that tomorrow.
Does it track with the gap?
Yes. Okay. Very well.
So, at the gap, you just...
The mean, yeah, the mean value of delta tracks the Arpes number very well, even though you have massive variations on the nanometer scale.
Yeah, but his question is whether the energy scale where you see the strongest inhomogeneity correlates with the gap, because the gap is getting smaller as you overdose.
Yeah, it does, just as you would expect. So it's like a random distribution of different dopings would be a simple way. So I actually don't claim that that's the situation, but that would be a simple way of viewing it. So here's a surface. Let's measure the IDV at zero bias in this surface. You see a small number of zero bias resonances. These are due to impurity atoms, and you're at zero magnetic field. Now turn on the field in the same location. Now you can see it's the same location because you'll see that if you look carefully, let me see if I can find some examples. Yeah, look at these two guys here. So they're going to shift by a few angstroms, but they're still there. And that's true for the other features as well. The 7 Tesla did shift it by maybe 50 angstroms. But the other thing you see is some new object appearing. Here's one. This is here at 7 Tesla, and it's not there at zero. Now there's another one up there. You can see them all throughout this field of view. So something happens when the field comes on. If we go to one of these locations, let's go to that location. This is the spectrum we find. So here's the D2 IDV squared far away from one of those objects. Here's the spectrum at that object. So you can see the coherence peaks are destroyed for about 7 angstroms from the symmetry point. Then this unknown gap, which was discovered by Christoph Renner in the Fischer group, it remains. So there are proposals that this is the pseudo gap revealed by killing the superconducting order parameter in the core. And then down in here, we found the core states in 2212. And they're, I mean, it's hard to say exactly what energy they're at, but the maximum change from the background is near 7 millivolts. So that 7 millivolts is important. If I take a 7 Tesla DIDV map at 0 millivolts, I see all this stuff. But if I do it at 7 millivolts, I primarily see where the vortex cores are, because that's where the maximum contrast is. Now we can go to one of those locations. Oh, I'm sorry. Now we can show that these are the vortices. We take a big field of view in different magnetic fields. At 7 Tesla, we analyze this on the assumption that each one of these objects is a vortex. We can use a Voronoi diagram to count the amount of flux associated with each one of those objects. And it's very, very close to a single flux quantum, H over 2E flux quantum. So with high precision, we know, well, with precision in the range of a few parts in 1,000, we know that each one of these objects has one flux quantum associated with, giving confidence that they are vortex cores. Now, this gives us a feeling for a common phenomenology of the cuprate vortex core. So here is the YBCO result, and here's the BISCO result. The coherence peaks are destroyed. The coherence peaks are destroyed. There's a core state at finite energy. There's a core state at finite energy. And these objects are relatively large, although the place where the order parameter is destroyed is only 10 angstroms or something. the region where this response occurs is 100 angstroms or 150 angstroms. There's no zero bias conductance peak, however.
What's the 10 angstroms and the 150 angstroms?
I'll show you the raw data in a second, and you'll see. There's at least three different empirical scales associated with this object. In summary, these observations, which is now pretty widely accepted, they're in poor agreement with the x squared minus y squared core in the BCS model. So we have a mystery on our hands. So one thing which was proposed now about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, is that the strange results could be due to the stabilization of another superconducting, change in the symmetry of the superconducting order parameter. So a simple situation is that you would stabilize some S-wave component nearby the D-wave component. So the overall spectrum would be gapped, and it would look something like this. That would allow you to bind states. Then there's no node, so you could bind Karoly-Degen states, which could be consistent with the data. But the only problem is that this is a big signal. You know, to bind a state at 7 millivolts, you'd need a gap, let's say, 10 millivolts or more. One would just go to that location and see the gap if it existed. It's never been seen. So we don't see an induced gap, a fully gapped situation where there is an induced gap of, say, 10 millivolts everywhere on the Fermi surface. Okay, so the only resource of an experimentalist is to go for more resolution and see what's down inside those objects. So let's go to one of these vortex cores, which in a big field of view is just a little blob, additional density of states at 7 millivolts. And let's ask what really happens there. So this is a series of spectra measured, separated by 2.61 angstroms, traveling towards a vortex core, going through the center of a vortex core and exiting on the other side. Here you see the coherence peaks, very smooth, low density of states. You approach the core, the coherence peaks decay, and they're gone. And then behind this shoulder here, they recover. Same on this side. They decay, they disappear, they recover. Look down near the Fermi level. Nothing, nothing, nothing. And then there start to be perturbations, and then states that whose intensity varies as a function of location. And these also appear to be particle hole symmetric. And if you just look down this valley, you can see that there is something being produced inside at the location of the vortex core. So this is the raw data. So as I mentioned earlier, the material is extremely heterogeneous in the electronic structure. So there's a lot of background variation. But if I just show you this experiment for several different vortices, here's one, here's another one, here's another one. So clearly there are a lot of variations in what goes on there, but the basic phenomenon is, with signal-to-noise maybe three, repeatable in this experiment. Okay, now let's consider what happens to the coherence peak as a function of distance from the core, and this is part of the answer to the question. So here's three different vortices. Here is what we believe is the symmetry point. So the coherence peak has a certain height. When you approach within about 40 angstroms, it begins to decay. When you get in here, it's gone. On the other side, it reappears, and then it goes back out again. If I average that data together, the coherence peak height as a function of distance, you have the bulk average coherence peak. Then you have this apparently linear disappearance of the coherence peaks. Then you have this approximately 12 angstrom radius object where the coherence peaks are destroyed. They recover in 12 angstroms. They reappear at 12 angstroms, and they recover at 40 angstroms, and you're back to bulk. Now, the data associated with this looks something like this. In here at the symmetry point, they're gone, but the core states are there. When you're halfway out, the coherence peaks have partially recovered, and the core states are there. And then when you get out to infinity for these objects, which is about 40, 50 angstroms for the coherence peak, there is a very weak core state down here. You can't resolve it in this experiment. So we wanted to study the spatial structure of these states. So we decided to do the following thing, to take high spatial resolution and to integrate over energy to find out what happens to these additional states as a function of location in space. So we studied this field of view, to which we have good, very good atomic register and resolution. And this register was maintained through fairly heroic efforts by Eric Hudson to and Jenny Hoffman, within about one angstrom, even though the field was changed by up to 7 Tesla. So the procedure is take a topographic image. This is our navigational map. It allows us to label locations. Then measure the IDV as a function of energy, position, and that zero magnetic field throughout that exact field of view. Now, even in the spectroscopic map, we have some very good navigational points because there is a small number of nickel resonances, purity resonances. Now, we turn on the magnetic field and identify exactly the same field of view with the best precision we can. And now we measure the local density of states, or DIDV, as a function of E, X, Y, and B at some fixed B. So in zero field, let me do that again. I'm going to show you the map of the local density of states in that field of view as a function of energy. There's really not a lot of activity. So turn on the field, register to the same location, and now let's see, this is a 5 Tesla field, let's see what happens. See these objects? These are associated with the vortices. And you can see it's the same field of view. I mean, look at this, and this. Here they are, this, and this. We're still registered. But now we see that there are significant, of course we knew there were additional states there, but now we see that they're not a homogeneous object. They have some spatial structure. So to amplify the contrast and let us see what we're looking at, we subtracted the... Yes. Say again, please. Yes, everything I'm discussing today is near optimal domain. So... we take the signal with the field on minus the signal field off and sum over energy. In this field of view, in a 5 Tesla magnet, we see this structure. So this is the so-called checkerboard. There is a periodic modulation of the low energy quasiparticle states surrounding an object which is a very small vortex core. Its radius is in the 10 angstrom range, but this distance here is in the 100 angstrom range. So this is a kind of an external object. We can do this at different magnetic fields to make sure that we're dealing with vortex cores. So in the same field of view, this is at 2 Tesla, there's just 2 vortices in here. 4 Tesla, there's 4 or 5. 5 Tesla, I showed you that already. 7 Tesla, you start to see some more. Well, you see there are some technical challenges to do this, but you can see the vortices moving around and still having this checkerboard associated with them at all different magnetic fields. We can do this with different tips. Of course, in STM, one has to be sure that one is not dealing with a particular tip or sample. These are 2 completely different samples, 2 completely different tips, 2 completely different operators, but they have the same checkerboard phenomenon produced at the vortex core location. So we're pretty confident of the empirical facts of the existence of this object in association with the core of the vortex in 2212. So if we take the Fourier transform of this data set to extract periodicity information, this is the Fourier transform. There is a long wavelength heterogeneity. We see the locations of the atoms coming through into the Fourier transform. We see the supermodulation here. That's what these 4 dots are. And then we see these 4 points here. They're near a quarter zero surrounding this object. So the precision, the accuracy is important, of course. One needs to know where this object is with rather high accuracy. to be sure that one knows where this object is. And that's where the high precision in the topographic imaging is important.
Is this the square root of the power spectrum, or this, is this a direct Fourier transform?
No, this is the square root of the power spectrum. This may even be the power spectrum, but there's no phase information. So here's a line cut through that Fourier transform along this trajectory. Here's the location of the atoms. So that defines our ruler, tells us the precision with which we know distances in reciprocal space. This was the power spectrum. And here is the response at the vortex cores. Here's the famous 0.25 point here. And this guy is consistent with that number, but if you actually took the peak there, you would say that, I'll come back to that. So here's the picture we have in our mind. There is a checkerboard of density of states modulations surrounding a small vortex core. Here's the autocorrelation of some raw data. So here's a summary. There is a checkerboard, an energy integrated checkerboard of period 4.2 plus or minus 0.6. It's in the copper-copper or copper-oxygen bond direction. This is the energy we integrate over, and the spatial decay length is about 30 angstroms of this object. The precision here is not limited by technology. It's limited by the fact that these are small objects. So in Fourier space, you will get some extended object. And it's very difficult to get beyond that challenge. A small field of view, let's just imagine studying one vortex. A small field of view means 2 pi over that field of view is the resolution in Fourier space. And that's poor resolution if the field of view is small. Okay. Well, that's not bad. So at present, there are two classes of ideas being discussed in association with these and other observations about the vortex cores. One is that another order parameter is being induced or revealed nearby the vortex core. And the second one is that these effects are due to quasiparticle scattering. And of course, one can always have some combination of those two as a perfectly reasonable solution. So let's talk about the order parameter. Originally, the SO5 picture was that one nearby the vortex core, one could rotate from the superconducting order parameter into the commensurate antiferromagnetic order parameter. This is the work of Orovis, Berlinski, Callan, and Susheng Zhang. And the periodicity of this response, of course, is not consistent with what we observe. And this is also an antiferromagnetic signal, which, I mean, we don't detect magnetism. We detect the quasiparticle density of states. But nonetheless, this is a very important launching point for discussion of these issues. Here's the work of Demler, Sachdev, and Zhang. And they argued that neutron and subsequently STM experiments could be viewed from the point of view that there's a nearby mixed superconductivity and SDW phase and even a pure SDW phase. And by applying the magnetic field, one could cross that boundary and stabilize the other phase nearby the vortex core. And again, in this picture, the spatial periodicity of the spin density wave is a parameter which appears in different calculations for the theory. And the precise effect on the quasiparticles, at least at this stage, was not predicted. And here's an early calculation to try and predict the effect on the quasiparticles from Ting et al., calculating the local density of states in the presence of an assumed commensurate antiferromagnetism and D-wave superconductivity. If I remember, this was a cylindrical Fermi surface. Now, the reason why from the empirical side of things, the discussion is of the creation of some spin and or charge density wave nearby the vortex core, and then a subsequent influence on the quasiparticles, which can be observed by STM. And of course, the key motivating experiment for those ideas from the experimentalist point of view is this work of Bella Lake and Gabe Epley and colleagues. They showed that in LSCO, there is something which can be described as a fluctuating spin density wave with a spatial periodicity of 8 unit cells oriented in the copper-copper oxygen bond direction. And these objects have a large correlation length, and they're created by the magnetic field. Now, obviously, they don't image the vortices, but the neutron scattering observations are consistent with this picture of the situation. And then there's the work, this is NMR work from Bill Halperin's group, showing that indeed there are strongly enhanced antiferromagnetic spin fluctuations appearing as you approach the core of a YBCO vortex. Here's work of Kekovich et al., Mark Kastner, and Bergeneau. They show that in in oxygen to lanthanum copper oxide, there's a static antiferromagnetic order parameter with this same periodicity and orientation and with a big correlation length produced by the magnetic field. Here's more work by Bella Lake and collaborators showing also that at a different doping in LSCO, there is a static periodic spin density signal produced by the magnetic field. So these results clearly point to the fact that some magnetism is being created and stabilized near the vortex cores, or at least that's the interpretation. Now, more recent studies of these issues have shown that at least in theory, one can find a description of the situation in which there is a spin density wave with, let's say, 8-unit cells and a charge density wave with 4-unit cells stabilized near the vortex core. This is a numerical calculation from Zhu, Martin, and Alan Bishop showing that result. And then in a quite different picture, but I could be subject to correction, it appears again that by Franz, Sheehy, and Tazanovich, it appears that within this vortex fluctuation D-wave superconducting model, their QED theory, they also produce some checkerboard-like pattern in the quasiparticle density of states. And there's a recent work by Susheng Zhang which proposes that if one could image the Cooper pairs, which is asking for a lot, actually, one would see a checkerboard in the core of the vortex associated with these phenomena, a checkerboard of the Cooper pairs.
What does that mean?
It means that the...
Tunneling from a superconducting.
Scan Josephson tunneling microscopy. Well, theoretically, it's a well-defined question. Yeah. And then more work from Sachdev and also Vojta to expand and amplify on their picture of spin and charge order being localized near the vortex cores in the cuprates. Okay, so recently another possibility has come to the fore, and that's quasiparticle interference. Of course, the theory for these ideas is not recent. It came from Doug Scalapino's group now almost exactly, 9 years ago. If there are scatterers in a D-wave superconductor, the quasiparticle states will be mixed by scattering and produce an interference term. And then that will result in oscillations in the wavelength of the local density of states. So this was for a point-like scatterer in S-wave. This is for a point-like scatterer in a relatively simple D-wave environment. You see there is a lot of response in theory. And this response could, in principle, be detected by STM, and that was actually proposed as a way before the ARPAs had really determined the electronic structure in some of these materials. This was proposed as another way of extracting that information. So recently, Donghai Li and I have been working on this problem. Here's a paper from Wang and Li on ConMet, describing two of the possible scattering processes on the Fermi surface. One is this almost nested one here, and the other one is this diagonal one. And then showing how, for a given parameterization of the Fermi surface, which came from the Argon ARPAs data, that the length of these vectors disperses in two very characteristic ways as a function of energy. And this one would think of as a test of whether or not this quasiparticle scattering effect is going on, because it's strictly, tightly related to the Fermi surface.
This would be just around an impurity.
The two introductory slides I show here, this one was a point-like impurity, And this calculation here was done for point-like impurities.
So this will be just around the impurity. So you should see the impurity around that, this kind of structure.
Correct. Right. Okay. And then depending on how you patch more and more of them together, you might get some incoherent world filled of these things.
A real mess.
Yeah.
But the experiments were done with magnetic field.
Yes.
You were imaging things inside the vortex.
Yes.
What's the connection?
I'll tell you right now. So so this is just a little bit about the experimental results on that subject. We can measure the local density of states, then take the Fourier transform of each map at each energy, and then measure the dispersion. This is the dispersion in the pi zero direction. We can measure that dispersion. And when we do so, so that's this green data here, the dispersion of those states is consistent with what it should be from our knowledge of where the Fermi surface is. So this is some prima facie evidence that there is quasi-particle interference in the material. Now let's come to the vortex cores. So the question on the table is it possible that this quasi-particle scattering process off these vortex cores, let's say Andreev-like scattering from the destruction of the order parameter, could produce the checkerboard? And here I provide the answer. It's unknown. This problem has really not been solved in the amount of realistic detail which would be necessary. You need the correct Fermi surface. You need the correct energy gap structure. You actually need the band structure for the quasiparticles. Then you need the correct self-consistent model for the destruction of the order parameter near the core. And then you need to solve to see what happens.
You can also look around real and impurity to see if there is similarity.
Yeah, well, these effects are... Yeah, these effects.
You can look what is going on around the impurity and inside the core, the core vortex, to see what is the differences.
Okay, well, there are some similarities and some differences. So I think I'll have to defer that discussion until tomorrow because I have to discuss the other material first. Now, so I introduced two possibilities, the stabilization of another order parameter, spin charge density wave, it could be stripes pinned to the core, it could be some other incommensurate order parameter stabilized near the core of the vortex. And then I introduced the idea of quasiparticle scattering. So could we distinguish between these two? And now I'm discussing the challenges we're facing in this experiment. We're trying to solve this problem right now. So there's a great deal of theoretical work on this question, but we tried to boil down the various ideas into predictions which could be tested, let's say, within the lifetime of one graduate student, a doable prediction. So one of them is that if there really is charge density modulation, we have other techniques for finding it. I showed you what a CDW looks like in niobium diselenide. In the topographic, in the integrated density of states image, if there is a serious charge redistribution, you will see it in that image. A second point, a second testable or perhaps testable idea is that if there is another order parameter with fixed wave vector, then what would expect is that the local density of states modulations should appear with that wave vector, with no other wave vectors, and remain at that wave vector. In a simple scattering potential picture, the scattering potential has a fixed wave vector, and one would expect some modulation associated with that.
It doesn't seem in contradiction with what you see. And the first two points seem in contradiction with what you're saying.
Well, it's important for me to be clear now. We do not empirically, experimentally know the answer to these two questions in the presence of the magnetic field. That's the main challenge we're facing.
Well, I thought the modulation was seen just at a very narrow energy range, not...
That's where we looked. Okay, so it remains to be determined whether that modulation would reach right up to the edge of the band that we're dealing with, then it would be a CDW, or whether it is a low-energy quasiparticle phenomenon.
Yeah.
So, you know, I apologize for that. We did the wrong experiment, but we didn't know that these were the key issues when we were carrying out that study. And again, this non-dispersive thing, I'll comment on this. And you know, one might expect a big peak in the scattering intensity when, if there's a quasiparticle scattering phenomenon, when the quasiparticles become commensurate with the order parameter wave vector, one might expect a big peak in the quasiparticle scattering in a simple picture. All right, so here's the topographic image study. you take a image, you should, one would see an intense charge density wave due to the nesting, Pearl's instability in a material. So this is a picture of the surface of 2212 in the presence of a 5 Tesla magnetic field, and there are 7 vortices in there. And we have tried a number of ways to extract a topographic signal, the most detailed of which is the subtraction of this image with the field on, with the field off image subtracted, and we cannot find evidence for an integrated density of states. Now that's a signal to noise statement. It doesn't mean there is no perturbation to the integrated density of states. It means with our present signal to noise, we cannot find it.
In niobium disulfide, what energy range are you integrating over
that? 100 millielectron volts. I'm sorry, I took it away, but this is 100 millielectron volts. But if you did,
you could look at energy.
You could look at any energy, you would see this. Yeah, anywhere in the band associated with this instability, you would see this image. So I don't say that this phenomenon is absent here, but if it is here, it's very, very weak. So another thing one could do is to search to see whether the dispersive, so the wave vector of this phenomenon is along the pi zero direction, which is the same direction as this zero field data. And we know the dispersion of this scattering process. So you could say, let's go to a vortex and measure the dispersion of these states at the vortex and see, do they disperse as determined by the band structure? But unfortunately, one faces a very serious problem there. The field of view that we're dealing with here for one of these vortices is about 150 angstroms or 40 unit cells. So that, well, 2 pi over this number is the resolution of the Fourier transform, which is about 2.5% of the reciprocal unit cell. So this is 25% of the reciprocal unit cell, and these lines are separated by approximately 2.5%. And what you see is that the dispersion we're looking for the resolution of the experiment is just one piece of data with this Q vector and one piece with that Q vector. You wouldn't actually be able to measure the dispersion. All one could do is say whether or not it changed from one pixel to the next. So that's really a challenge, which is very difficult to avoid. It's just Fourier's theorem. Of course, if the vortex core could become much more extended, let's say at a high field or at low doping, then one could avoid this problem. But at present, the small field of view limits the Q-space resolution. I'm not sure that we can distinguish whether or not these things are dispersing. So this work was done primarily by Eric Hudson and Jenny Hoffman. And for the remaining 10 minutes of the talk, I plan to discuss ruthenate, strontium ruthenate. So if you have questions about this material, maybe now would be a good time.
You're betting on the second theory?
Well, we know the quasiparticle interference effect exists in the zero field case. So there's some prima facie evidence that it could or should exist in the presence of the magnetic field. But on the other hand, you have to look at the neutron work. When the magnetic field is on, something else happens near these cores, a periodic modulation in the spin. So it's difficult to rationalize. So maybe those two things are properties of two different materials. That's a possibility. Certainly the neutron work has not been done in 2212 yet. But another possibility is, okay, there really is something stabilized near the core. And what we're seeing in the presence of a magnetic field is maybe some mixture of maybe it's some mixture of different phenomena. We really don't know.
Do you have a simple idea what can be that core state in either one of those pictures? Because it seems to me that's the most salient feature, right?
So you mean?
How do you understand that extra state that is bound? Is it some?
Well, suppose it's a quasiparticle interference effect.
Right.
Now we know there are some dominant. Because of the structure of the Fermi surface and the structure of the superconducting energy gap, there's only a small number of Q vectors which are available for scattering at a given energy, 7 to be precise. So, and we know that some of those in the zero field case produce much more intense scattering than others. So let's assume for the sake of argument that one of those Q vectors interacts very strongly. So the quasiparticles at that Q vector interact strongly with the vortex core. Then one can imagine just a standing wave scattering pattern sitting around the vortex core. Then it would not be a bound state. It's not a state bound in the core. It's a response of the homogeneous electronic structure outside this object. So that's one picture. So the alternative picture is that there really is another order parameter there. Let's say a magnetization modulation. Mm-hmm. The expectation value of Sz squared is modulated in space. And the quasiparticles scatter off that object. Then again, they would be modulated with the same Q vector because there is a potential with the correct Q vector.
Yeah, but what sets the energy for that?
In the second case, it would be set by the band structure. One can perform a fairly detailed, in principle, it seems to me that one could perform a fairly detailed calculation from the band structure to figure out what would happen in the quasiparticle interference case. In the other case, I don't know what sets the energy.
You were showing this pattern inside the core in which there is this this bump on the side. Then you were showing that there are points in which the signal is higher and the signal is more. At that point, this shape is the same, so it's somehow is decreasing and increasing of this kind of signal. That is when you show inside the core, there is black and white.
Yes.
Now, if you take the image on the black and the image on the white, essentially yes. The shape is the same as the total intensity, which is low.
Yeah, essentially in a band of energy, the density of states change is going up and down,
maintaining the same structure.
Yeah.
It's an overall factor which is changing. This kind of modulation is an overall
to the local density of states, correct.
The checkerboard, sorry, is in the 1-0 direction, yeah?
Correct. And that's true for both the neutron experiment and the STM experiment, so that although they're on different materials, they appear to be related. Okay, let's quickly discuss strontium ruthenate. We have a few minutes. Isostructural to LSCO. It's got two and only two layers, and it needs no chemical dopant atoms. It's a good metal. So there's the ruthenium oxide layer, which is believed by many to support, it definitely supports an exotic superconductor and possibly a P wave. And then there's a strontium oxide layer about which not a great deal is known. A tremendous amount is known about the Fermi surfaces. There are three sheets to the Fermi surface. So this is a very challenging project for which we had to develop a new instrument, because since TC is 1.5 Kelvin, you usually need to go down to a tenth of TC, say 150 millikelvin, and you need a high magnetic field. So Barry Barker and Sudeep Dutta built this high-precision millikelvin STM, and it's with this instrument that these results were taken. Here's some details. So the common cleave surface of strontium ruthenate is the SRO surface, which is beautifully clean and flat. We see this many, many times, but it doesn't have a superconducting spectrum. It has some kind of a gapped spectrum, which is possibly associated with a CDW, but it doesn't have a simple one point, let's say, if TC is 1.5 Kelvin, then delta might be 0.5 or 0.3 millielectron volts. This surface does not have that spectrum. We know that it is the strontium ruthenate surface from one of the substitution experiments in collaboration with Maeno. At the ruthenium site, titanium atoms were substituted. And then when we image the surface, we can see the location of the titanium atoms. And these white dots here are the location of the strontium atoms in the surface. You see the titanium atom is not underneath the strontium atoms. It's underneath the space in between four of them. Then if you look at the diagram, you'll see that that's geometrically what one would expect. And we know these are the titanium atoms because we've done different doping densities of them. And the site where they substitute is known from a variety of probes. So we think we can identify this as the strontium ruthenate surface. It doesn't have a lot of information about the superconductivity. However, we have observed another surface which looks very strange. It looks like this. This is 256 angstroms. And you have this apparent one-dimensional reconstruction. It's not completely one-dimensional because every now and then it can switch through 90 degrees. And then it has a complicated pattern of high and low density of states. This is a topographic image integrated up to minus 100 millielectron volts. This surface, even though it looks very strange, the periodicity of the reconstruction of these guys is 4-unit cells, and of these little blobs here is 2-unit cells. But it has a good spectrum. So from the point of view of the empiricist, we can start to do experiments. Now, we believe that this is the spectrum of the superconductivity in at least one sheet of the strontium ruthenate because this gap disappears at 1.44 Kelvin. Its value here is close to 400 microelectron volts at our lowest temperature. That's 2 delta over KTC of 6.4. We do have a normal density of states here, even at millikelvin temperatures, which is 0.4 of the background. And that is something to worry about. And we can quench this thing at HC2 for the C-axis, which gives really good evidence that it is C-axis tunneling into the strontium ruthenate order parameter. Now, that order parameter, let's start with the fitting procedures. If we try to fit S-wave, it's a very poor fit, and I'll show you it's a very poor fit as a function of temperature as well. This is our minimum temperature. We think our tip is near 250 millikelvin, so this is the temperature that we take for the Fermi function of the tip to make the fit. The fit is poor. Another fit would be a line node, a simple line node like this, and this fit would be equivalent for a vertical line node as well. This fit is better, but it's definitely not the best fit available. So another fit would be a sum of a fully gapped plus, let's say on one sheet, plus a line node on another sheet. This fit is beginning to be pretty good. You see the chi-squared is order of magnitude better than the other ones. And this order parameter here, which is a horizontal line node plus a shift, has the best fit, but only by a small amount. This is a pretty good fit. Now, as a function of temperature, this data was taken at 12 millikelvin, but like I say, we think the tip is near 250 millikelvin. We can check, all the different fits against the data. And then as a function of temperature, so here is the spectrum taken on that surface, and it doesn't vary from location to location when the field is off, as a function of temperature from 12 millikelvin up to 1.5 Kelvin, you can see a continuous evolution of the spectrum as you would expect for tunneling into a superconductor.
So you said the tip's at 250 millikelvin?
Yeah.
Sorry, could you recomment on that?
It's technically very difficult to cool a small object down to temperatures below about between one.
And you know its temperature from what?
We're not certain. We have done studies of the tunneling spectrum of this tip onto a superconducting molybdenum surface, whose BCS spectrum we know very well. Now, we know the temperature of the piece of molybdenum because the thermometer is right on top of it. It was cooled down to 15 millikelvin. Then we look at the tunneling spectrum and say, if all the broadening is coming from the other electrode being hot, what would be the best fit? Well, the best fit is in the 250 millikelvin range. Now, there are ways to deal with this technical problem, but while we were doing this experiment, we didn't want to, change the instrument. So there's a continuous evolution in the spectrum in a very satisfactory fashion. And you could say, how does the S-wave spectrum evolve? How do the various candidates evolve? And again, for a variety, for all temperatures, the horizontal line node with an offset is the best fit. And so here is delta in millielectron volts, delta maximum in the presence of that horizontal line node. There's our measurements. This is also quite satisfactory. Now, just a technical comment. If the gap is 300 microvolts and you need to resolve it, let's say within 10%, now you're talking about 30 microvolt tunneling. So you have a vacuum high impedance junction, let's say a gigaohm, and you apply 20 microvolts, the current is incredibly small. The spectroscopic mapping techniques we use do not work under those conditions. So we try to improve the situation by pushing the tip in as hard as we can so that the tunnel junction is in the tens of megaohm range, but that's the suicide range for STM. Then, you know, a few picometers of perturbation, it touches the surface and you're finished. So Sudeep Dutta did this heroic series of experiments where he found the vortex lattice. So there's a zero bias peak in the core of the ruthenate vortex, and that's at these locations. It makes a square lattice. The superconducting gap was checked at a variety of locations around this object, and then we measured the evolution of the spectrum from the symmetry point here into the center of the core to try and help us understand what the ruthenate core looks like. Here's the raw data. Here in the front, you're at this position over here, about 1,000 angstroms away. Oh, since the critical field is 70 millitesla, here we're at around 60 millitesla. That means the vortices are very far apart. So this distance is like 1,000 angstroms. So we begin here, we have the spectrum far from the core, and we begin to approach. Within about 500 angstroms, we see the zero bias peak rising up in a fashion which is very reminiscent of the fully gapped case, the niobium diselenide case. And here's the difference between the middle point between two cores is this white data, and the center point is this data here. Now, we tried our best to determine if there's any azimuthal symmetry breaking in this structure, and with signal-to-noise maybe 3, we don't find any. But that's a weak statement, much weaker than the other ones I've made. So what we can say is we can see the vortex cores in ruthenate. They're the right size. They do make a square lattice, as had been previously discovered by the neutron scattering studies. And I think there is an opportunity now to use quasiparticle tunneling spectroscopy to get information about the symmetry of this very interesting P-wave order parameter, possibly P-wave.
The
coherence length is about 600 angstroms, and the range over which this thing makes its way, this range is around 500 angstroms where this peak exists. So in summary, we finally found the surface after a fairly painful search, which we believe to be the ruthenium oxide surface. Although it looks kind of complicated, it has a nice spectrum which is independent of location. 2 delta over KTC is around 6. We have 40% of density of states, even at the lowest temperature, which is not superconducting. That's not consistent with heat capacity and other thermodynamic probes. So one possibility is that we're terminating the different sheets differently. Only one of, let's suppose the dominant sheet is still superconducting, that's 60%, and the other two sheets are terminated in a bad, you know, in a fashion which is destructive to the induced superconductivity. That's the
terminated. What does that mean?
When you terminate the bands by cleaving the surface, then you may perturb what happens to the superconductivity in that region.
There is only one band, which is x squared minus what, not something.
Correct.
And the other two is perpendicular.
Yes.
Probably they just destroyed by the
surface. So a simple explanation, which is unproven, is that what we're dealing with is the dominant superconducting sheet, and the other ones have just dropped out of the problem. There is a zero bias conductance peak in this core. After years of not finding one in the cuprates, it was fun to find one at last. And there is a square lattice. And this work was done by Barry Barker and Sudeep Dutta, and a new worker in the group, Christian Lupien. Thank you very much.
Questions? No, but thanks again. Tomorrow at 10.